At the same time, I felt an unhinged urge to laugh at the terrible farce of the situation. Fergus endured everything in total silence, and when Jamie had finished and stepped back, pale and sweating, the small body lay so still that I was afraid for a moment that he had died of shock, if not from the actual effects of the beating. But then a deep shudder seemed to run over the small frame, and the boy slid backward and raised himself stiffly off the table. Jamie leapt forward to grasp him by an arm, anxiously smoothing back the sweat-drenched hair from his forehead.
"Are you all right, man?" he asked. "God, Fergus, tell me you're all right."
The boy was white to the lips, and his eyes were the size of saucers, but he smiled at this evidence of goodwill on the part of his employer, buck teeth gleaming in the lamplight.
"Oh, yes, my lord," he gasped. "Am I forgiven?" "Jesus Christ," Jamie muttered, and clasped the boy tightly against his chest. "Yes, of course you are, fool."
He held the boy at arm's length and shook him slightly.
"I dinna want to do that ever again, do you hear me?"
Fergus nodded, eyes glowing, then broke away and fell to his knees before me.
"Do you forgive me also, madame?"
he asked, folding his hands formally in front of him and looking trustfully up, like a chipmunk begging for nuts. I thought I would expire on the spot of mortification, but mustered sufficient self-possession to reach down and raise the boy to his feet.
"There's nothing to forgive," I told him firmly, my cheeks burning. "You're a very courageous lad, Fergus. Why don't you go and have some supper now?"
At this, the atmosphere of the kitchen relaxed, as though everyone had drawn a massive sigh of relief at once. The other servants pushed forward, babbling concern and congratulations, and Fergus was swept off to a hero's reception, while Jamie and I beat a precipitous retreat back to our quarters above stairs.
"Oh, God," Jamie said,
collapsing into his chair as though completely drained.
"Sweet bleeding Jesus, Mary, Michael and Bride. Lord, I need a drink. Don't move," he exclaimed in alarm, though I hadn't made a move toward the bell rope. "I couldn't have bear to face one of the servants just now."
He got up and rummaged in the cupboard.
"I think I've a bottle in here, though."
He had indeed a nice aged Scotch. Removing the cork unceremoniously with his teeth, he lowered the level of the spirit by an inch or so, then handed the bottle to me. I followed his example without hesitation.
"Jesus Christ," I said, when I had recovered breath enough to speak.
"Yes," he said,
taking the bottle back and taking another gulp. Setting the bottle down, he clutched his head, running his fingers through his hair until it stood on end in wild disarray. He laughed weakly.
"I've never felt so foolish in my entire life. God, I've felt a clotted."
"So did I," I said, taking my turn at the bottle. "Even more than you, I imagine. After all, it was all my fault. Jamie, I can't tell you how sorry I am. I never imagined..."
"Ah, dinna worry yourself."
The tension of the last half hour released, he squeezed my shoulder affectionately.
"You couldn't have any idea. Neither did I, for that matter," he added reflectively. "I suppose he thought I'd dismiss him and he'd be back in the streets. Poor little bugger. No wonder he thought himself lucky to take a beating instead."
I shuddered briefly, remembering the streets through which Monsieur Fauré's carriage had travelled. Beggars dressed in rags and sores clung stubbornly to their territories, sleeping on the ground even on the coldest nights, lest some rival steal a profitable corner from them. Children much smaller than Fergus darted through the market crowds like hungry mice, eyes always watching for the dropped crumb, the unguarded pocket. And for those too unhealthy to work, too unattractive to sell to the brothels, or simply too unlucky, it would be a short life indeed, and far from merry. Little wonder if the prospect of being thrust from the luxury of 3 meals a day and clean clothes back into that sordid stew had been sufficient to send Fergus into paroxysms of needless guilt.
"I suppose so," I said.
My manner of intake had declined from gulps to a more genteel sipping by this time. I sipped genteelly, then handed the bottle back, noting in a rather detached manner that it was more than half empty.
"Still, I hope you didn't hurt him."
"Weel, he doubt he'll be a bit sore."
His Scots accent, usually faint, always grew more pronounced when he drank a lot. He shook his head, squinting through the bottle to judge the level of spirit remaining.
"Do you know, Sasnach, I never till tonight realised just how difficult it must have been for my father to beat me. I always thought it was me had the hardest part of that particular transaction."
He tilted his head back and drank again, then set down the bottle and stared owl-eyed into the fire.
"Being a father might be a bit more complicated than I'd thought. I'll have to think about it."
"Well, don't think too hard," I said. "You've had a lot to drink."
"Och, don't worry," he said cheerfully. "There's another bottle in the cupboard."
Chapter 15, in which music plays a part. We stayed up late with the second bottle, going over and over the latest of the abstracted letters from the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, otherwise known as His Majesty James III, and the letters to Prince Charles from Jacobite supporters.
"Fergus got a large packet bound for His Highness," Jamie explained. "There was a lot of stuff in it, and we couldn't copy it all quickly enough. So I kept some to go back the next time."
"See," he said, extracting one sheet from the pile and laying it on my knee.
"The majority of the letters are in code, like this one. I hear that the prospects for grouse seem most favourable this year in the hills above Salerno. Hunters in that region should find themselves successful." "That's easy. It's a reference to Manzetti, the Italian banker. He's from Salerno. I found that Charles had been dining with him and managed to borrow 15,000 livres. Apparently James's advice was good. But here..."
He shuffled through the stack, pulling out another sheet. "Look at this," Jamie said, handing me a sheet covered with his lopsided scrawls. I squinted obediently at the paper, from which I could pick out single letters, connected with a network of arrows and question marks.
"What language is that?" I asked, peering at it. "Polish?"
Charles Stuart's mother, the late Clementina Sobieski, had been Polish after all.
"No, it's in English," Jamie said, grinning. "You canna read it?"
"You can?"
"Oh, aye," he said smugly. "It's a cipher, Sasnach. I know a very complicated one. See, all you must do is break the letters up into groups of 5. To start. Only you don't count the letters Q or X. The X's are meant as breaks between sentences, and the Q's are only stuck in here and there to make it more confusing."
"If you say so,"
I said, looking from the extremely confusing-looking letter, which began Merti or Cruti, Lopro Quast Min, to the sheet in Jamie's hand with a series of 5-letter groups written on one line, single letters printed in carefully above them, one at a time.
"So, one letter is only substituted for another, but in the same order," Jamie was explaining. "So if you have a fair amount of text to work from, and you can guess a word here or there, then all you need do is to translate from one alphabet to the other, see?"
He waved a long strip of paper under my nose with 2 alphabets printed one above the other, slightly offset.
"Well, more or less," I said.
"I gather you do, though, which is what's important.
What does it say?"
The expression of lively interest with which Jamie greeted all manner of puzzles faded a bit, and he let the sheet of paper fall to his knee. He looked at me,
lower lip caught between his teeth in introspection.
"Well," he said, "that's what's odd. And yet I dinna see how I can be mistaken."
The tone of James's letters overall tend one way, and this ciphered one spells it out clearly. Blue eyes met mine under thick ruddy brows.
"James wants Charles to find favour with Louis," he said slowly, "but he isn't looking for support for an invasion of Scotland. James has no interest in seeking restoration to the throne."
"What?" I snatched the sheaf of letters from his hand, my eyes feverishly scanning the scribbled text. Jamie was right. While the letters from supporters spoke hopefully of the impending restoration, James's letters to his son mentioned no such thing, but were all concerned with Charles making a good impression upon Louis. Even the loan from Manzetti of Salerno had been sought to enable Charles to live with the appearance of a gentleman in Paris, not to support any military end.
"Well, I'm thinking James is a canny wee man," Jamie had said, tapping one of the letters. "For see, Sassenach, he's very little money of his own. His wife had a great deal, but Uncle Alex told me that she left it all to the church when she died. The Pope has been maintaining James's establishment. After all, he's a Catholic monarch, and the Pope is bound to uphold his interests against those of the Elector of Hanover."
He clasped his hands around one knee, gazing meditatively at the pile of papers now laid between us on the sofa.
"Philip of Spain and Louis, the old king, I mean, gave him a small number of troops and a few ships 30 years ago with which to try to regain his throne. But it all went wrong. Bad weather sank some of the ships, and the rest had no pilots and landed in the wrong place. Everything went awry, and in the end, the French simply sailed off again, with James not even setting foot upon the soil of Scotland. So perhaps, in the years since, he gave up any thought of getting back his throne. But still, he had 2 sons coming to manhood, and no way to see them properly settled in life. So, I asked myself, Sassenach," he rocked backward a bit, "what would I do in such a situation? The answer being that I might try and see if my good cousin Louis, who's King of France after all, might maybe see one son established in a good position, given a military appointment maybe, and men to lead. A general of France is no bad position in life."
I nodded, thinking. "Yes, but if I were a very smart man, I might not just come to Louis and beg, as a poor relation. I might send my son to Paris and try to shame Louis into accepting him at court, and meanwhile keep alive the illusion that I was actively seeking restoration."
"For once James admits openly that the Stuarts will never rule Scotland again," Jamie added softly, "then he has no more value to Louis."
And without the possibility of an armed Jacobite invasion to occupy the English, Louis would have little reason to give his young cousin Charles anything beyond the pittance that decency and public opinion would force him to provide. It wasn't certain. The letters Jamie had been able to get, a few at a time, went back only as far as last January, when Charles had arrived in France. And couched in code, cipher, and guarded language generally, the situation was far from clear. But taken all in all, the evidence did point in that direction. And if Jamie's guess as to the Chevalier's motives was correct, then our task was accomplished already, had never, in fact, existed at all. Thinking over the events of the night before, I was abstracted all the next day through a visit to Marie d'Arbonville's morning salon to hear a Hungarian poet, through a visit to a neighbourhood herbalist's to pick up some valerian and orris root, and through my rounds at l'Hôpital des Anges in the afternoon. Finally, I abandoned my work, afraid that I might accidentally damage someone while wool-gathering.
Neither Meurtor nor Fergus had yet arrived to escort me home, so I changed out of my covering gown and sat down in Mother Hildegard's vacant office to wait, just inside the vestibule of the hôpital. I'd been there for perhaps half an hour, idly pleating the stuff of my gown between my fingers, when I heard the dog outside. The porter was absent, as he often was. Gone to buy food, no doubt, or run an errand for one of the nuns. As usual, in his absence, the guardianship of the hôpital's portals was given into the capable paws and teeth of Bouton. The first warning yip was followed by a low, burring growl that warned the intruder to stay where he was, on pain of instant dismemberment. I rose and stuck my head out of the office door to see whether Father Balmont might be braving the peril of the demon once more in pursuit of his sacramental duties. But the figure outlined against the huge stained-glass window of the entry hall wasn't the spare form of the junior priest. It was a tall figure, whose silhouetted kilt swayed gracefully around his legs as he drew back from the small toothed animal at his feet. Jamie blinked, brought up short by the assault. Shading his eyes against the dazzle from the window, he peered down into the shadows.
"Oh, hello there, wee dog," he said politely, and took a step forward, knuckles stretched out. Bouton raised the growl a few decibels, and he took a step back. "Oh, like that, is it?" Jamie said.
He eyed the dog narrowly.
"Think it over, laddie," he advised, squinting down his long, straight nose. "A madame sight bigger than you. I wouldn't undertake any rash ventures if I were you."
Bouton shifted his ground slightly, still making a noise like a distant fokker.
"Faster, too," said Jamie, making a feint to one side.
Bouton's teeth snapped together a few inches from Jamie's calf, and he stepped back hastily. Leaning back against the wall, he folded his arms and nodded down at the dog.
"Well, you've a point there, I'll admit. When it comes to teeth, you've the edge on me, and no mistake."
Bouton cocked an ear suspiciously at this gracious speech, but went back to the low-pitched growl. Jamie hooked one foot over the other, like one prepared to pass the time of day indefinitely. The multicoloured light from the window washed his face with blue, making him look like one of the chilly marble statues in the cathedral next door.
"Surely you've better things to do than harry innocent visitors?" he asked conversationally. "I've heard of you. You're the famous fellow that sniffs out sickness, no? Well, then, why are they wasting you on silly things like door guarding, when you might be making yourself useful smelling gouty toes and pustulant arseholes? Answer me that, if you will."
A sharp bark in response to his uncrossing his feet was the only answer. There was a stir of robes behind me as Mother Hildegard entered from the inner office.
"What is it?" she asked, seeing me peering round the corner. "Have we visitors?"
"Bouton seems to be having a difference of opinion with my husband," I said.
"I don't have to put up with this chicken,"
Jamie was threatening. One hand was stealing toward the brooch that held his plaid at the shoulder.
"One quick spring with my plaid and I'll have you trussed up like a—" "Oh, bonjour, madame,"
he said, changing swiftly to French at the sight of Mother Hildegard.
"Bonjour, Monsieur Fraser."
She inclined her veil gracefully, more to hide the broad smile on her face than in greeting, I thought.
"I see you have made the acquaintance of Bouton. Are you perhaps in search of your wife?"
This, seeming to be my cue, I sidled out of the office behind her. My devoted spouse glanced from Bouton to the office door, plainly drawing conclusions.
"And just how long have you been standing there, Sassenach?"
he asked dryly. "Long enough," I said, with a smug self-assurance of one in Bouton's good books. "What would you have done with him once you'd got him wrapped up in your plaid?"
"Thrown him out of the window and run like hell," he answered, with a brief glance of awe at Mother Hildegard's imposing form. "Does she, by chance, speak English?"
"No, luckily for you," I answered. I switched to French for the introductions. "Ma mère,
Je vous présente mon mari, le seigneur de Bortour.
Milord?
Mother Hildegard had by now mastered her sense of humour, and greeted him with her usual expression of formidable geniality.
We shall miss your wife, but if you require her, of course. I didn't come for my wife,
Jamie interrupted. I came to see you, ma mère.
Seated in Mother Hildegard's office, Jamie laid the bundle of papers he carried on the shining wood of her desk.
Bouton,
keeping a wary eye on the intruder, lay down at his mistress's feet. He laid his nose upon his feet, but kept his ears cocked, lip raised over one eye-tooth, in case he should be called upon to rend the visitor limb from limb. Jamie narrowed his eyes at Bouton, pointedly pulling his feet away from the twitching black nose.
"Herr Gerstmann recommended that I consult you, Mother, about these documents," he said,
unrolling the thick sheaf and flattening it beneath his palms. Mother Hildegard regarded Jamie for a moment, one heavy brow raised quizzically. Then she turned her attention to the sheaf of papers, with that administrator's trick of seeming to focus entirely on the matter at hand, while still keeping her sensitive antennae tuned to catch the faintest vibration of emergency from the far-off reaches of the hôpital.
"Yes?" she said.
One blunt finger ran lightly over the lines of scribbled music, one by one, as though she heard the notes by touching them. A flick of the finger, and the sheet slid aside, half exposing the next.
"What is it that you wish to know, Monsieur Fraser?" she asked.
"I don't know, Mother."
Jamie was leaning forward, intent. He touched the black lines himself, dabbing gently at the smear where the writer's hand had carelessly brushed the staves before the ink had dried.
"There is something odd about this music, Mother."
The nun's wide mouth moved slightly in what might have been a smile.
"Really, Monsieur Fraser? And yet I understand. You will not be offended, I trust. That to you, music is a lock to which you have no key."
Jamie laughed, and her sister, passing in the hallways, turned, startled by such a sound in the confines of the hôpital. It was a noisy place, but laughter was unusual.
"That is a very tactful description of my disability, Mother, and altogether true. Were you to sing one of these pieces?"
His finger, longer and more slender, but nearly the same size as Mother Hildegard's, tapped the parchment with a soft rustling noise.
"I couldn't tell it from the Kyrie Eleison, or from La Dame Fabien, except by the words," he added with a grin.
Now it was Mother Hildegard's turn to laugh.
"Indeed, Monsieur Fraser," she said. "Well, at least you listen to the words."
She took the sheaf of papers into her hands, riffling the tops. I could see the faint swelling of her throat above the tight band of her wimple as she read, as though she were singing silently to herself, and one large foot twitched slightly, keeping time. Jamie sat very still upon his stool, good hand folded over the crooked one on his knee, watching her. The slanted blue eyes were intent, and he paid no attention to the ongoing noise from the depths of the hôpital behind him. Patients cried out, orderlies and nuns shouted back and forth, family members shrieked in sorrow or dismay, and the muted clang of metal instruments echoed off the ancient stones of the building, but neither Jamie nor Mother Hildegard moved. At last she lowered the pages, peering at him over the tops. Her eyes were sparkling, and she looked suddenly like a young girl.
"I think you are right," she said. "I cannot take time to think it over carefully just now."
She glanced toward the doorway, momentarily darkened by the form of an orderly dashing past with a large sack of lint.
"But there is something odd here."
She tapped the pages on the desk, straightening them into an orderly stack.
"How extraordinary," she said. "Be that as it may, Mother, can you, with your gift, discern what this particular pattern is?" It would be difficult. I've reason to suppose that it is a cipher and that the language of the message is English, though the text of the songs is in German.
Mother Hildegard uttered a small grunt of surprise.
English? You are sure?
Jamie shook his head.
Not sure, no, but I think so. For one reason, there is the country of origin. The songs were sent from England.
Well, monsieur, she said, arching one eyebrow, your wife speaks English, does she not? And I imagine that you will be willing to sacrifice her company to assist me in performing this endeavour for you.
Jamie eyed her, the half-smile on his face, the mirror image of hers. He glanced down at his feet where Bouton's whiskers quivered with the ghost of a growl.
I'll make you a bargain, mother, he said. If your wee dog doesn't bite me in the ass on the way out, you can have my wife.
And so, that evening, instead of returning home to Jared's house in the Rue Trémoulin, I took supper with the sisters of the Couvent des Anges at their long refectory table and then retired for the evening's work to Mother Hildegard's private rooms. There were three rooms in the superior's suite. The outer one was furnished as a sitting room with a fair degree of richness. This, after all, was where she must often receive official visitors. The second room was something of a shock, simply because I wasn't expecting it. At first, I had the impression that there was nothing in the small room but a large harpsichord made of gleaming polished walnut and decorated with small hand-painted flowers sprouting from a twisting vine that ran along the sounding board above glowing ebony keys. On second look, I saw a few other bits of furniture in the room, including a set of bookshelves that ran the length of one wall, stuffed with works on musicology and hand-stitched manuscripts, much like the one Mother Hildegard now laid on the harpsichord's rack. She motioned me to a chair placed before a small secretary against one wall.
"You will find blank paper and ink there, my lady. Now, let us see what this little piece of music may tell us."
The music was written on heavy parchment, the lines of the staves cleanly ruled across the page. The notes themselves, the clef signs, rests, and accidentals, were all drawn with considerable care. This was plainly a final clean copy, not a draft or a hastily scribbled tune. Across the top of the page was the title, Lied des Landes, a song of the country.
"The title, you see, suggests something simple, like a Volkslied," Mother Hildegard said, pointing one long bony forefinger at the page. "And yet the form of the composition is something quite different. Can you read music at sight?"
The big right hand, large-knuckled and short-nailed, descended on the keys with an impossibly delicate touch. Leaning over Mother Hildegard's black-clad shoulder, I sang the first three lines of the piece, making the best I could of the German pronunciation. Then she stopped playing and twisted to look up at me.
"That is the basic melody. It then repeats itself in variations, but such variations. You know, I've seen some things reminiscent of this, by a little old German named Bach. He sends me things now and again."
She waved carelessly at the shelf of manuscripts.
"He calls them inventions, and they're really quite clever, playing off the variations in two or three melodic lines simultaneously. This," she pursed her lips at the lead before us, "is like a clumsy imitation of one of his things. In fact, I would swear that..."
Muttering to herself, she pushed back the walnut bench and went to the shelf, running a finger rapidly down the rows of manuscripts. She found what she was looking for and returned to the bench with three bound pieces of music.
"Here are the Bach pieces. They're fairly old. I haven't looked at them in several years. Still, I'm almost sure."
She lapsed into silence, flipping quickly through the pages of the Bach scripts on her knee, one at a time, glancing back now and then at the lead on the rack.
"Ha!"
She let out a cry of triumph and held out one of the Bach pieces to me.
"See there?"
The paper was titled Goldberg Variations, in a crabbed, smeared hand. I touched the paper with some awe, swallowed hard,
and look back at the lead. It took only a moment's comparison to see what she meant.
"You're right. It's the same," I said. "A note different here and there, but basically it's exactly the same as the original theme of the Bach piece. How very peculiar."
"Isn't it?" she said in tones of deep satisfaction. "Now, why is this anonymous composer stealing melodies and treating them in such an odd fashion?"
This was clearly a rhetorical question, and I didn't bother with an answer, but asked one of my own. "Is Bach's music much in vogue these days, Mother?" I certainly hadn't heard any at the musical salons I attended.
"No," she said, shaking her head as she peered at the music.
"Herr Bach is not well known in France. I believe he had some small popularity in Germany and in Austria 15 or 20 years ago, but even there his music is not performed much publicly. I'm afraid his music is not the sort to endure. Clever, but no heart."
"Hmm.
Now, see here."
The blunt forefinger tapped here and here and here, turning pages rapidly.
"He has repeated the same melody, almost, but changed the key each time. I think this is perhaps what attracted your husband's notice. It is obvious even to someone who doesn't read music, because of the changing signatures, the note tonique."
It was. Each key change was marked by a double vertical line, followed by a new treble clef sign, and the signature of sharps or flats.
5 key changes in such a short piece," she said, tapping the last one again for emphasis, "and changes that make no sense at all in terms of music. Look, the basic line is precisely the same, yet we move from the key of 2 flats, which is B-flat major, to A major, with 3 sharps. Stranger yet, now he goes to a signature of 2 sharps, and yet he uses the G-sharp accidental."
"How very peculiar," I said.
Adding a G-sharp accidental to the section in D major had the effect of making the musical line identical with the A major section. In other words, there was no reason whatsoever to have changed the key signature.
"I don't know German," I said. "Can you read the words, Mother?"
She nodded, the folds of her black veil rustling with the movement, small eyes intent on the manuscript.
"What truly execrable lyrics," she muttered to herself. "Not that one expects great poetry from Germans in general, but really, still."
She broke off with a shake of her veil.
"We must assume that if your husband is correct in assuming this to be a cipher of some sort, that the message lies embedded in these words. They may therefore not be of great import in themselves."
"What does it say?" I asked.
"My shepherdess frolics with her lambs among the verdant hills," she read. "Horrible grammar, though of course liberties are often taken in writing songs. If the lyricist insists upon the lines rhyming, which they nearly always do if it is a love song."
"You know a lot about love songs?" I asked curiously.
"Full of surprises tonight was Mother Hildegard." "Any piece of good music is, in essence, a love song," she replied matter-of-factly. "But as for what you mean, yes, I have seen a great many. When I was a young girl..." She flashed her large white teeth in a smile, acknowledging the difficulty of imagining her as a child. "I was something of a prodigy, you understand. I could play from memory anything I heard, and I wrote my first composition at the age of 7.
She gestured at the harpsichord, the rich veneer shining with polish.
"My family has wealth. Had I been a man, no doubt I would have been a musician."
She spoke simply, with no trace of regret.
"Surely you could still have composed music, if you'd married?" I asked curiously.
Mother Hildegard spread her hands, grotesque in the lamplight. I had seen those hands wrench loose a dagger embedded in bone, guide a displaced joint back into alignment, cup the blood-smeared head of a child emerging from between its mother's thighs.
and I had seen those fingers linger on the ebony keys with the delicacy of moth's feet.
"Well," she said, after a moment's contemplation, "it is the fault of Saint Anselm."
"It is?"
She grinned at my expression, her ugly face quite transformed from its stern public facade. "Oh, yes. My godfather, the old Sun King," she added casually, "gave to me a book of the lives of the saints for my own saint's day when I was 8. It was a beautiful book," she said reminiscently, "with gilded pages and a jewelled cover, intended more as a work of art than a work of literature. Still, I read it, and while I enjoyed all of the stories, particularly those of the martyrs, still there was one phrase in the story of St. Anselm that seemed to strike a response in my soul."
She closed her eyes and tilted back her head, recalling.
"St. Anselm was a man of great wisdom and great learning, a doctor of the church, but also a bishop, a man who cared for the people of his flock and looked after their temporal needs as well as those of the spirit. The story detailed all of his works and then concluded in these words, 'And so he died at the conclusion of an eminently useful life, and thus obtained his crown in paradise.'"
She paused, flexing her hands lightly on her knees.
"There was something about that that appealed most strongly to me. An eminently useful life."
She smiled at me.
"I could think of many worse epitaphs than that, milady."
She spread her hands suddenly and shrugged, an oddly graceful gesture.
"I wished to be useful," she said.
Then, dismissing idle conversation, she turned abruptly back to the music on the rack.
"So," she said, "plainly the change in the key signatures, the note tonique, that is the oddity. Where can we go with that?"
My mouth dropped open with a small exclamation. Speaking in French as we had been, I hadn't noticed before. But observing Mother Hildegard as she told her story, I'd been thinking in English. And when I glanced back at the music, it hit me.
"What is it?" the nun asked. "You've thought of something."
"The key," I said, half laughing. "In French, a musical key is the note tonique, but the word for an object that unlocks..." I pointed to the large bunch of keys, normally carried on her girdle, that Mother Hildegard had laid aside on the bookshelf when we came in. "That is a passe-partout, isn't it?"
"Yes," she said,
watching me in puzzlement. She touched the skeleton key in turn.
"Une passe-partout."
"That one," she said, pointing to a key with barrel and wards, "is more likely called a clé."
"A clé!"
I exclaimed joyously. "Perfect!" I stabbed a finger at the sheet of music before us. "See, ma mère, in English the words are the same. A key gives the basis of a piece of music, and a key unlocks. In French, the clé is a key, and in English, the clef is also part of the musical signature. And the key of the music is also the key to the cipher. Jamie said he thought it was an English cipher, made by an Englishman with a really diabolical sense of humour too," I added. With that small insight, the cipher proved not too difficult to unravel. If the maker was English, the ciphered message likely was in English too, which meant that the German words were provided only as a source of letters. And having seen Jamie's earlier efforts with alphabets and shifting letters, it took only a few tries to determine the pattern of the cipher. 2 flats means you must take every second letter, starting from the beginning of the section," I said, frantically scribbling down the results. "And 3 sharps means to take every 3rd letter, beginning at the end of the section. I suppose he used German both for concealment and because it's so bloody wordy. It takes nearly twice as many words to say the same thing as it would in English."
"You have got ink on your nose," Mother Hildegard observed.
She peered over my shoulder.
"Does it make sense?"
"Yes," I said, my mouth gone suddenly dry. "Yes, It makes sense. Deciphered, the message was brief and simple, also deeply disturbing. His Majesty's loyal subjects of England await his lawful restoration. The sum of £50,000 is at your disposal. As an earnest of good faith, this will be paid only in person upon His Highness's arrival on the soil of England, I read. And there's a letter left over, an S. I don't know if that's a signature of sorts, or only something the maker needed to make the German words come out right.
Hmm.
Mother Hildegard glanced curiously at the scribbled message, then at me.
You will know already, of course, she said with a nod. But you may assure your husband that I will keep this in confidence.
He wouldn't have asked your help if he didn't trust you, I protested. The sketchy brows rose to the edge of her wimple, and she tapped the scribbled paper firmly.
If this is the sort of endeavour in which your husband engages, he takes considerable risk in trusting anyone. Assure him that I am sensible of the honour, she added dryly.
I'll do that, I said, smiling.
Why, chère madame, she said, catching sight of me, you are looking quite pale. I myself often stay awake far into the night when I am working on a new piece, so I tend to pay little attention to the hour. But it must be late for you.
She glanced at the hour candle burning on the little table near the door.
Gracious, it is growing late. Shall I summon Sister Madeleine to take you to your chamber?
Jamie had agreed reluctantly with Mother Hildegard's suggestion that I spend the night at the Couvent des Anges, so that I needn't return home through the dark streets late at night. I shook my head. I was tired, and my back ached from sitting on the stool, but I didn't want to go to bed. The implications of the musical message were too disturbing to permit me to sleep right away in any case.
Well, then, let us take a little refreshment in celebration of your accomplishment.
Mother Hildegard rose and went to the outer room, where I heard the ringing of a bell. Shortly, one of the serving sisters came, bearing a tray of hot milk and small iced cakes, and followed by Bouton. The serving sister placed a cake on a small china plate and set it on the floor before him as a matter of course, laying beside it a bowl of milk. While I sipped my own hot milk, Mother Hildegard set aside the source of our labours, laying it on the secretary, and instead placed a loose sheaf of music manuscript on the rack of the harpsichord.
"I shall play for you," she announced. "It will help to compose your mind for sleep."
The music was light and soothing, with a singing melody that wove back and forth from treble voice to bass in a pattern of pleasing complexity, but without the driving force of Bach. "Is that yours?" I asked, choosing a pause as she lifted her hands at the conclusion of the piece. She shook her head without turning around.
"No, a friend of mine, Jean-Philippe Rameau, a good theorist, but he doesn't write with great passion."
I must have dozed, the music lulling my senses, for I woke suddenly to the murmur of Sister Madeleine's voice in my ear, and her warm, firm grip under my arm, lifting me to my feet and leading me away. Looking back, I could see the broad span of Mother Hildegard's black swathed back and the flex of powerful shoulders beneath the drape of her veil as she played, oblivious now to the world beyond the sanctum of her chamber. On the boards near her feet lay Bouton, nose on his paws, small body laid straight as the needle of a compass.
"So," Jamie said, "it's gone a little further than talk, maybe."
"Maybe?" I echoed. "An offer of £50,000 sounds fairly definite." £50,000 by current standards was the yearly income of a good-sized duchy. He raised one eyebrow cynically at the musical manuscript I had brought back with me from the convent.
"Aye, well, an offer like that is fairly safe if it's contingent on either Charles or James setting foot in England.
If Charles is in England, it means he's gotten sufficient backing from other places to get into Scotland first.
No, he said, rubbing his chin thoughtfully.
What's interesting about this offer is that it's the first definite sign we've seen that the Stuarts, or one of them at least, are actually making an effort at mounting a restoration attempt.
One of them? I caught the emphasis.
You mean you think James isn't in on this?
I looked at the coded message with even more interest.
The message came to Charles, Jamie reminded me. And it came from England, not through Rome. Fergus got it from a regular messenger, in a packet marked with English seals, not from a papal messenger. And everything I've seen in James's letters.
He shook his head, frowning. He hadn't yet shaved, and the morning light caught random sparks of copper among the auburn stubble of his beard.
The packet had been opened. Charles has seen this manuscript. There was no date on it, so I dinna ken how long ago it came to him. And of course we don't have the letters Charles has sent to his father. But there's no reference in any of James's letters to anyone who could possibly be the composer, let alone to any definite promises of support from England.
I could see the direction in which he was heading. And Louise de la Tour was babbling about how Charles meant to have her marriage annulled and claim her as his wife once he was king. So you think perhaps Charles wasn't just talking through his hat to impress her?
Maybe not, he said.
He poured water from the bedroom ewer into the basin and laved his face with water, preparatory to shaving.
So it's possible that Charles is acting on his own? I said,
horrified and intrigued by the possibility.
That James has set him up for a masquerade of pretending to start a restoration attempt in order to keep Louis impressed with the Stuarts' potential value, but...
But Charles isn't pretending?
Jamie interrupted.
Aye, that's how it seems. Is there a towel there, Sassnach?
Eyes screwed shut and face dripping, he was patting about on the surface of the table. I moved the manuscript to safety and found the towel draped over the foot of the bed. He examined his razor critically, decided it would do, and leaned over my dressing table to look in the mirror as he applied shaving soap to his cheeks.
Why is it barbaric of me to take the hair off my legs and armpits, and it isn't barbaric for you to take it off your face? I asked, watching him draw his upper lip down over his teeth, as he scraped under his nose with tiny, delicate strokes.
"It is," he replied, squinting at himself in the mirror. "But it itches like a fiend if I don't."
"Have you ever grown a beard?" I asked curiously.
"Not on purpose," he replied,
half-smiling as he scraped one cheek.
"But I've had one now and then, when I couldna help it, when I lived as an outlaw in Scotland. When it came to a choice between shaving in a cold burn with a dull razor every morning, or itching, I chose to itch."
I laughed, watching him draw the razor along the edge of his jawbone with one long sweep.
"I can't imagine what you'd look like with a full beard. I've only seen you in the stubbly stage."
He smiled on one side of his mouth, drawing the other up as he scraped under the high, broad cheekbone on that side.
"Next time we're invited to Versailles, Sassnach, I'll ask if we may visit the Royal Zoo. Louis has a creature there that one of his sea captains brought him from Borneo, called an orangutan. Ever seen one?"
"Yes," I said. "The zoo in London had a pair before the war."
"Then you'll know what I look like in a beard," he said,
smiling at me as he finished his shave with a careful negotiation of the curve of his chin.
"Scraggly and moth-eaten. Rather like the Vicomte Marigny," he added. "Only red."
As though the name had reminded him, he returned to the main topic of discussion, wiping the remains of soap off his face with the linen towel.
"So, I suppose what we must do now, Sassnach," he said, "is to keep a sharp eye out for Englishmen in Paris."
He picked up the manuscript off the bed, and riffled the pages thoughtfully.
If anyone is actually willing to contemplate support on this scale, I think they might be sending an envoy to Charles. If I were risking £50,000, I might like to see what I was getting for my money, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would, I answered. And speaking of Englishmen, does His Highness patriotically buy his brandy wine from you and Jared, or does he by chance patronise the services of Mr. Silas Hawkins?
Mr. Silas Hawkins, who is so eager to know what the political climate is like in the Scottish Highlands?
Jamie shook his head at me admiringly.
And here I thought I'd married you because you had a fair face and a fine fat ass. To think you've a brain as well.
He neatly dodged the blow I aimed at his ear and grinned at me.
I don't know, Sassenach, but I will before the day is out.
Chapter 16. The Nature of Sulphur. Prince Charles did purchase his brandy wine from Mr. Hawkins. Beyond that discovery, though, we made little progress over the course of the next 4 weeks. Things continued much as before. Louis of France continued to ignore Charles Stuart. Jamie continued to run the wine business and to visit Prince Charles. Fergus continued to steal letters. Louise, Princesse de Rohan, appeared in public on the arm of her husband, looking doleful but blooming. I continued to throw up in the mornings, work at the hôpital in the afternoons, and smile graciously over the supper table in the evenings. Two things happened, though, that looked like being progress toward our goal. Charles, bored at confinement, began to invite Jamie to go to taverns with him in the evening, often without the restraining and discretionary presence of his tutor, Mr. Sheridan, who professed himself much too old for such revels.
"Good, the man drinks like a fish," Jamie had exclaimed, returning from one of these jaunts reeking of cheap wine.
He examined a large stain on the front of his shirt critically.
"I'll have to order a new shirt," he said.
"Worth it," I said, "if he tells you anything while he's drinking. What does he talk about?"
"Hunting and women,"
Jamie said succinctly, and declined firmly to elaborate further. Either politics didn't weigh as heavily on Charles's mind as did Louise de la Tour, or else he was capable of discretion, even in the absence of his tutor, Mr. Sheridan. The second thing that happened was that Monsieur Duveny, the Minister of Finance, lost at chess to Jamie. Not once, but repeatedly. As Jamie had foreseen, the effect of losing was merely to make Monsieur Duveny more determined to win, and we were invited frequently to Versailles, where I circulated, collecting gossip and avoiding alcoves, and Jamie played chess, generally collecting an admiring crowd to watch, though I didn't myself consider it much of a spectator sport. Jamie and the Minister of Finance, a small round man with stooped shoulders, were bent over the chessboard, both apparently so intent on the game as to be oblivious to their surroundings, despite the murmur of voices and the clink of glasses just beyond their shoulders.
"I have seldom seen anything so wearisome as chess," murmured one of the ladies to another. "Amusement, they call it. I should be more amused watching my maid pick fleas off the black page boys. At least they squeal and giggle a bit."
"I shouldn't mind making the red-haired lad squeal and giggle a bit," said her companion, smiling charmingly at Jamie, who had lifted his head, and was gazing absently past Monsieur Duveny.
Her companion caught sight of me and dug the lady, a luscious blonde, in the ribs. I smiled pleasantly at her, rather nastily enjoying the deep flush that rose from her low neckline, leaving her complexion in rosy blotches.
As for Jamie, she could have twined her plump fingers in his hair for all the notice he would have paid, so abstracted did he seem.
I wondered just what was occupying his concentration.
Surely it wasn't the game.
Monsieur Duveny played a dogged game of cautious positioning, but used the same gambits repeatedly. The middle two fingers of Jamie's right hand moved slightly against his thigh, a brief flutter of quickly masked impatience, and I knew that whatever he was thinking of,
It wasn't the game. It might take another half hour, but he held Monsieur Duvenet's king in the palm of his hand. The Duc de Nevers was standing next to me. I saw his dark little eyes fix on Jamie's fingers, then flick away. He paused meditatively for a moment, surveying the board, then glided away to increase his wager. A footman paused by my shoulder and dipped obsequiously, offering me yet another glass of wine. I waved him away. I had had enough during the evening, that my head was feeling light and my feet dangerously far away. Turning to look for a place to sit down, I caught sight of the Comte Saint-Germain across the room. Perhaps he was what Jamie had been looking at. The Comte, in turn, was looking at me, staring at me, in fact, with a smile on his face. It wasn't his normal expression, and it didn't suit him. I didn't care for it at all, in fact, but bowed as graciously as I could in his direction, and then pushed off into the throng of ladies, chatting of this and that, but trying wherever possible to lead the conversation in the direction of Scotland and its exiled king. By and large, the prospects for a Stuart restoration didn't seem to be preoccupying the aristocracy of France. When I mentioned Charles Stuart now and then, the usual response was a rolling of the eyes or a shrug of dismissal. Despite the good offices of the Earl of Mar and the other Paris Jacobites, Louis was stubbornly refusing to receive Charles at court. And a penniless exile who wasn't in the king's favour was not going to find himself invited out in society to make the acquaintance of wealthy bankers. "The king is not particularly pleased that his cousin should have arrived in France without seeking his permission," the Comtesse de Brabant told me when I had introduced the topic. "He has been heard to say that England can stay Protestant so far as he himself is concerned," she confided. "And if the English burn in hell with George of Hanover, so much the better." She pursed her lips in sympathy. She was a kindly sort. "I'm sorry," she said. "I know that must be disappointing to you and your husband, but really..." She shrugged. I thought we might be able to accommodate this sort of disappointment, and scouted eagerly for further bits of gossip along these lines, but met with little success this evening. Jacobites, I was given to understand, were a bore. "Rook to Queen's Pawn, 5, Jamie mumbled later that evening as we prepared for bed. We were staying as guests in the palace once more. As the chess game had lasted well past midnight, and the minister wouldn't hear of our undertaking the journey back to Paris at such an hour, we had been accommodated in a small appartement. This one a notch or two above the first, I noted. It had a feather bed and a window overlooking the south parterre. "Rooks, eh?" I said, sliding into the bed and stretching out with a groan. "Are you going to dream about chess tonight?" Jamie nodded, with a jaw-cracking yawn that made his eyes water. "Aye, I'm sure I will. I hope it will not disturb you, Sassenach, if I castle in my sleep." My feet curled in the sheer joy of being unfettered and relieved of my increasing weight, and my lower spine sent out sharp jolts of a mildly pleasant pain as it readjusted to lying down. "You can stand on your head in your sleep if you want," I said, yawning myself. "Nothing will bother me tonight." I have seldom been more wrong. I was dreaming of the baby. Grown almost to the birthing, it kicked and heaved in my swollen belly. My hands went to the mound, massaging the stretched skin, trying to quiet the turmoil within. But the squirming went on, and in the unexcited fashion of dreams, I realized that it wasn't a baby, but a snake that writhed in my belly. I doubled, drawing up my knees as I wrestled the serpent, my hands groping and pummeling, searching for the head of the beast that darted and thrust under my skin. My skin was hot to the touch, my intestines coiled, turning into snakes themselves, biting and thrashing as they twined together. "Claire, wake up, lass. What's amiss?"
The shaking and calling roused me at last to a fuzzy apprehension of my surroundings. I was in bed, and it was Jamie's hand on my shoulder and the linen sheets over me. But the snakes continued to writhe in my belly, and I moaned loudly, the sound alarming me almost.